Interview. I'm Mary Sinanidis. Joining us today is Alex Hawke, Australia's Minister for Immigration, Citizenship, Migrant Services and Multicultural Affairs, a man who has said he's a proud son of the Greek diaspora. Mr. Hawke is also a loyal ally of Prime Minister Scott Morrison and took on his ministry at a complex time. He was recently promoted in a reshuffle where he will retain all of his existing responsibilities but also join cabinet. Fresh from his promotion, he's with us today to talk about multiculturalism at a time of COVID, his heritage, and what makes him tick. Minister Hawke, welcome.
Hi, Mary.
Hi. Congratulations on your promotion to cabinet to fill the vacancy left by Christian Porter. What does this mean for your portfolio of immigration and multiculturalism?
Yeah, thanks, Mary. That's a great question. It is important to have immigration in the cabinet. Most people will remember immigration is one of the cabinet portfolios that has been there almost all of Australia's federated history. And it's a constitutional power, the migration power, part of Australia's constitution. And the story of migration to Australia is the central Australian success story. I mean, Greeks after World War II, Italians, people from Asia all through the 70s and 80s, people from all around the world, the Middle East in the 90s, 2000s. Migration really is at the centre of Australia and its modern story, and it's back in cabinet. And one of the reasons it left was the standing up of the Home Affairs Department under Prime Minister Turnbull, the new Home Affairs Department. Mm-hmm. But it was only a short time, and having immigration and multicultural affairs brings it back at a critical time in the pandemic when we're just starting to come out, and we will have to see the return of people from all over the world, migrants, visitors, tourists, people who come here and make such a great contribution.
Well, that would be great, actually. And the Prime Minister said that it is time to give Australians their lives back, taking us a step closer to that coveted trip to Greece. Have you visited Greece?
You know something? I've never been to Greece my entire life. My mother was born there in a little village called Hortiatis outside of Thessaloniki up in the north. And, you know, they left after World War II. And so I think, you know, with my grandfather, who died before I was born, he was in the resistance. They fled after World War II. There was a Nazi massacre in that village as the Nazis left. I think many people from Greece understand this story, yeah, and the horrors of World War II and the aftermath of World War II. And for my family, it's quite psychological about going back. My grandparents went back a few times. Yaya's been back a few times. You know, but it was a new life, and it was very difficult for them to travel back for some of those reasons. So I've never had the chance to go, but my wife is Croatian, and we both want to, get to, Greece and Croatia as soon as we're able to with our children.
Yeah, so your papu died before you were born. What about Yaya? Were your grandparents a traditional post-war immigrants with doilies, Greek Orthodox traditions, Whitlam voters and the like?
Yeah, my Yaya was. The church was her life. I was baptised Greek Orthodox, of course, and mm-hmm. Found myself most of my life in Greek Orthodox churches, one way or another. Although not brought up as a more of a Protestant, but certainly in churches with the family. You know, she died sadly a few years ago, but she was the centre of that church, and her funeral, of course, it was 200 people from the church there. It was her whole life. It's a story that I think everyone here is quite familiar with. The struggles and the early arrivals, my papa used to, trade things, barter, yeah, back in the day in Wollongong, to build a pretty successful life. My mother was a teacher, and then their grandson becomes a member of parliament. It's pretty much the journey of every single person that came from Greece and building generational success.
That's true. Can you share a memory that you have of your yaya?
Well, every bit of food that she ever made me my whole life, there's nothing that'll ever compare.
What's your favourite?
Well, everything she ever made. She made great meatballs, she made great kalori, she made, just everything she did with love, and we'll never, ever, I think, find any food ever better ever again.
Yeah. Some people who won't be able to see their yaya anytime soon are the temporary visa holders of Australia. So they say they're devastated they've been excluded from the easing of border restrictions that will allow Australians and permanent residents to leave and re-enter the country. Why shouldn't double vaccinated temporary visa holders be allowed to visit their relatives back in Greece and other countries?
Well, we want to as soon as possible. There's no doubt about that. These harsh restrictions have been there for health and public safety and to save people's lives. You know, I had some people in my own electorate up here who we gave exemptions to go to. One young guy who had two young kids and from India, he went to India, he contracted COVID and he died. And he was there to visit, you know, the funeral of his grandfather, very sad circumstances. So the restrictions have been there for good reasons, to protect Australians and Australian lives. They've been there to protect sometimes people. I'm sure if he could take that back, he wouldn't go there and die and leave his kids behind. This is a real serious and sad situation. There's risk every way. But the rollout, the plan that the Prime Minister is now talking about, 70% vaccination, 80% vaccination, Phase C means we will reopen those borders, those exemptions will be wound back and people will be travelling again. But we will have probably avoided, you know, 30,000 deaths. And you know, I don't think anyone in Australia could really say we should have had those deaths in this terrible period.
That's true. And I think we had touched upon this at a presser in the past. I'd like to know about AstraZeneca. Has the AstraZeneca vaccine distributed in Australia been approved by the European Medicines Agency yet?
Well, you must mean another vaccine. AstraZeneca has been approved for a long time and manufactured locally. Are you thinking about Novavax or Moderna or which one?
I don't know. Are all the vaccines that we've currently got in Australia, are they also vaccines that are accepted in Europe and other countries?
Yeah. So you might mean another vaccine. AstraZeneca approved early on. It's widespread use all through the world and in Australia. I mean, we're up to 8-9 million AstraZeneca shots in Australia. Okay. They use AstraZeneca, you know, almost exclusively, their whole population, very safe, very good quality. Pfizer, very safe, very good quality. We've approved Moderna, safe, good quality. There are other vaccines that are coming on. The TGA will be approving them, but they have to go through their proper trials. But, you know, three main vaccines now in Australia. Each one of them is exceptionally safe. You get your proper medical advice, but you have now almost, you know, 9 million on both sides of these vaccines. Very, very safe to take.
Okay. The problem at the time was that AstraZeneca had the same ingredients as the European AstraZeneca, but for some reason it wasn't approved back then. So that was the thing, that it needed to go through the approval. It was more of a technicality than safety issue.
Well, we take advice from the Therapeutic Goods Administration in Australia, TGA, a world-leading regulator. The FDA in America, your listeners will be familiar with, and Europe has top regulators as well. They all have approved AstraZeneca as safe for use. And through the various age groups, it's been approved now for safety for the different ages, and it's available and very, very safe in Australia. And our advice is it's 100% safe.
Well, for our readers, it's very important to also be able to travel to Greece with these vaccines without quarantining. So that's like a huge issue and a huge motivator.
It is. It's very important. We're very aware how important those borders will be. Mm. We're doing all the work in the background, as you would expect, to get ready for travel. There are new requirements internationally, so we will have the technology to be able to handle that. Work is being done now. And as per the national roadmap, we're coming to the point where the vaccinations will allow people to start travelling. Australian citizens, permanent residents will be able to travel back and forwards. When we hit that 80% double vaccination mark, phase C, it's so close now. I think we're all getting pretty interested. The Prime Minister is talking about the end of the year and Christmas. I think we're on track to hit that. And that means, you know, we can have a better year next year and seeing our family. And so much for people to catch up on, and so many sad things. People have lost so many relatives overseas and not been able to sort of, you know, fix up family issues, and there's so much to do.
And time as well with their loved ones.
So indeed.
During a multicultural presser just 2 months ago, Neos Kosmos had asked whether Australia should do as Greece did and mandate vaccines. You had said at the time that the government made an upfront decision, a very important decision, not to mandate the vaccination. You said, in a country like Australia with a democratic and free tradition, this is a very important decision. Now, What led to a change in this policy?
So the federal government hasn't changed our policy. The national program is a voluntary program, so people can choose to get the vaccine or not. Certain state governments are talking about restrictions for people that don't get the double vaccination. Now, we support people getting the vaccination. We think they should. They should get the best medical advice for themselves. But we're not going to force people to do it. You must take a vaccination. We say you need to take a vaccination for your health, for your family's health, for your children's health, for society's health. But we're not looking at a program which will penalise people for not getting it. Once we get to a point where almost everyone has taken the vaccination, and you have to remember Australia is a country that has world-leading rates of vaccination acceptance at the best of times. We believe we'll get to 80. We believe we'll get to 90. We believe we'll get to the mid-90s in terms of vaccine acceptance. Once we get there, everyone has been given the opportunity to have a vaccine, and then it will be safe, of course, for people to completely have no restrictions. And that's what the national roadmap envisages as we go forward. But we've set up front, we won't force people to do that. We've never had that tradition in Australia. And, you know, it's very hard for governments to force whole populations to do anything. And we don't agree with that. But it's good to see voluntarily we're going to get 80, 90% because it's scientific, it's based on the medical advice, and people support vaccination overwhelmingly.
It is, though, a catch-22 situation when the federal government says you're free to choose, but the state government mandates it.
Well, it is. I know what you're saying. Some workplaces, we believe, have a right to do that. If you're in medical care, for example, I mean, you don't have a right to go to work with chickenpox or with smallpox or a disease. You know, you need to be vaccinated and safe to work in a hospital. Mm. COVID is no, you need to have a, so some workplaces have an absolute right to mandate vaccination. Food preparation could be another example. You don't have a right to have a communicable disease while you prepare food of any nature. You know, so there are lots of issues under this. We'll work through the issues, but I think our society's been so cohesive and kept together by this approach. Everyone's working together to get the vaccination and be sensible, convince that relative that's a bit sceptical. Most people are deciding to get it themselves under family pressure, under community pressure. We don't believe as a society the government should force everybody to do something. The states are taking some measures to make sure that people will be safe in various contexts. And I think if some of those are sensible and others, you know, we don't want to see business owners forced fined if an unvaccinated person gets served in their shop, for example. That is an unworkable system.
Yes. You came into your role as Immigration Minister fresh from serving as Assistant Minister for Defence, and you also served in the Army Reserve when at university. How has this background helped in your current role?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think military service at any time in your life is unique. It's something you value for your whole life. It helps you shape you as a better person. It did that for me. The Australian military is very professional, very highly regarded, and the service was great. You make some great mates, but it does build your character. And, you know, that time in my life is one of the most important in making me who I am today. I recommend it to people. I recommend it to young people out there doing some time in the military if that's for you. Is something that will, I think, in the Australian military, really give you great experience and great exposure to good discipline, good training, good skills. And in today's day and age, opportunities to sort of deploy in many key areas of the world that Australia supports United Nations operations.
Mr. Morrison recently commended you for your extraordinary job in the evacuation of citizens from Kabul. He said it was an incredible exercise done with enormous amount of effort and great skill. Do you think that your background helped in that?
Well, everything does in your background. I would recommend to everybody the role Australia played in this big crisis. That was Australia's biggest airlift. We moved 4,100 people in the matter of 7 to 10 days on emergency flights in a very dangerous and violent and chaotic situation. So our soldiers on the ground were magnificent. Our border force and home affairs officials were magnificent. The department people worked here overnight. My office worked 24/7 for a week. People really, Australians lean in when there's a crisis, and we lent into Afghanistan to rescue people we had an obligation to, who'd helped our military, who'd helped our foreign affairs, and we were able to rescue 4,100 people. And It's an incredible effort, and I really do thank everybody involved. Australians can be very proud of the way our country behaves at these times and what we do. And we are small, but we do a magnificent job when we're required, and there's nobody better than Australians to get in there and help.
Well, speaking of Australians, Australia is also a very multicultural country. However, it's quite monolingual. Do you speak any other languages? Milas Elinika?
No. So, you see, this was my mom's big choice. So, it's a great regret of mine that Greek was not my natural language. She was a teacher. She wanted me to excel in English. And having had to learn English herself, that's pretty common for many of your listeners. They want their children to integrate and to become, English is my best subject at school. It was what I was reading was my best, writing was, she was very proud of that. But for me, as an adult, I look back and think, I wish you had brought me up with Greek. There's plenty of things would tell me to do in Greek that I'll just do. I certainly understand a lot, but I never got to learn it.
Yeah, and that's a lot of Greeks would relate to that, especially second and third generation, even fourth. What about your wife? Does she speak Croatian?
A little bit as well, but not a lot. So it tends to be the next generation is the one that goes with English. But look, English is the national language. It's a good unifying language for the generation. It brings all of the multicultural threads together, and the government says that that's important. While we respect and absolutely encourage people to learn their additional languages, I think having a national language, English, means we all communicate the same language. And part of our big policy change in recent years is that all migrants now, unlike Greeks and Italians who came here and basically left to pick it up by themselves, we now give them unlimited adult migrant English training. They can go to as many hours of classes as they want to learn English. It costs a lot of money, Mary, but and everyone that's listening here, especially the older generations, know that investment in English for those new migrants from wherever they're from, and having the ability to go learn it, paid for by somebody else when they can't afford it, is going to unlock a lot of opportunity for those migrants.
It's very important, but I know that in Europe they have a more multilingual approach. People speak many languages. Do you think Australia should be more open to that, or do you think something should be done regarding that?
Well, Europe's very different. I mean, you've got, dozens and dozens of countries that have been together for thousands of years, and including, the Roman period, which had, you had overarching Latin. You've got reasons why there's multilingual, but basically the same base to the language in many countries there. But Australia, we were British settled. We had one language from the government from day one. A lot of different Aboriginal dialects, but, they obviously have not moved beyond Aboriginal people. And then English, though, in the world terms today, is used as the main language of commerce, the main language of trade, and these days the main language of diplomacy as well. So, our national language puts us in good stead in the world. But, of course, we support people learning languages, and we've got plenty of schooling in it, and hopefully more schooling in some Asian languages with our main trading partners in the region. But I think there's good historic reasons why English has become our national language.
Well, just to round up, I want to go back to your childhood when you were a child and a teenager, and Bob Hawke, a man with the same surname as you but with no connection, familial or political, was in office. How did your childhood growing up in Labor Australia influence your liberal mindset?
Yeah, that's a good question. I was pretty young, I've got to say, in the Hawke-Keating era, although I remember Keating more than Hawke, and that Keating might have helped me become a liberal, I must say, because he was different to Hawke, wasn't he? I had the opportunity to meet the former Prime Minister, Bob Hawke, and he was an exceptional person, and I had the opportunity to sit down with him a few days. His mind was first rate, as many people here will know, a great Australian Prime Minister, not just because he has the same surname, but his mind first class, and it showed. I can see what people saw in him and the way he ran government. But look, the Keating era was very divisive. And the Keating era was economically very bad. And when I was growing up, Keating was the main problem for Australia. High interest rates, people will remember, the economy suffering. It was certainly a time where I felt economically the Liberal Party offered the best opportunity for people that worked hard and paid taxes and had their own businesses.
Yes. So since 2019, you've been the third Minister of Immigration and Multiculturalism, and I'd like to know, how have you worked as a federal government to ensure this continuity?
Well, the good news is for Australia, since I came to Parliament, Mary, this is the reality people forget, but I joined Parliament in 2007, Since then, you know, we've had, you know, six prime ministers. It was one of the worst and most chaotic periods, that 10-year period where we had, you know, Rudd, Gillard, Rudd, Abbott, Turnbull, Morrison. If Scott Morrison completes the term, which I'm confident he will, but, you know, we all have to touch wood, he'll be the first Australian prime minister to start a term and finish a term since 2007. So I think we've all got to take a moment to make sure that we have one prime minister term to term. Sometimes we look at European countries. Sometimes we look at Greece, Mary, and we think the politics is a bit chaotic. But Australia's had a very chaotic, you know, period. And I would just encourage Australians. I know Australians. I hear from them a lot. They want one prime minister to stay for one period of time. And that is the best thing we can do for our country, is to keep one leader and one government for a period of time and then vote on them at the election, not change them halfway through. And I think we're going to get there this time. And then the people can make a choice about the next election, knowing that we've had one make it from turn to turn.
Minister Hawke, that concludes our interview. I'd like to thank you for your time. Ευχαριστώ πάρα πολύ. Do you know any Greek to share with us?
Look, I do, but I don't want to mangle it in front of your audience. So, you know, I won't. But I will thank you so much for your time and to
thank
the Greek
guests. Thank you very much for your time.